So, Bert, tell us about some ideas from the past week that you absorbed.
Oh, Bob, I listened to 6 interviews with you and Harold Channer last week.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
Oh, man.
To the scotch bottle. Boy.
Yes.
Boy. Bob, you're really consistent. I mean, from the first one all the way to the last one, the 6th one I heard, you were consistent. But Harold really changed. He was really fresh the first interview, but at the end, he sounds like the guy that I heard a week ago, man.
He's punch drunk.
There you go, punch drunk. Yes, very punch drunk. Ex-boxer, man. It's just it's really it's funny because just like you told me last week that it's always the same argument. But it was funny. One of the interviews, you laughed and told Harold, like, "Are you listening to us, Harold?"
That's right. He is not listening.
No. Not at all.
He does the same thing to Mark Stallman. I know his words. He does it so many times. He always says, "Well, we've been here 200,000 years, and Bucky Fuller says there's no more scarcity. We've reached a plateau where we can have no scarcity or blow ourselves up. What is your position on that?" This is what he's saying to Mark Stallman last week. He says, "I don't think he gets to say that to me eventually. I think that never it does the first couple things because he's going to do it always first time, but I don't remember that later. I cut him off at that point. You know, we do 10 sessions, so I'm saying, fuck that bullshit about you and the nuclear war. It's already happened, whatever I said. But no, really, I don't remember him doing that to me too much later on. But he does it to everybody.
And he always brings up Bucky Fuller. Every interview, he brought up Bucky Fuller.
Well,
he's
the one who says scarcity stopped in 1970. Harold's always quoting. And Harold, have you ever heard me talk about what happened to him that year? He was a professor up at New Paltz in New York City, and he didn't test his kids, his students, so he got in big trouble. And then the local authorities framed him and put him in jail. He got put in jail for a year, and he was leading the hippies and that up there. And so he comes out on his birthday in 1971. He gets let out. I think he goes to court and proves that he shouldn't have been put in jail. And he forgives everybody that did this to him because it's the end of the scarcity. We're in a new world. He quotes Bucky Fuller. He's been saying the same fucking thing for 50 fucking years.
Yes.
You have to realize this guy is a tape recording. He starts interviewing people in 73, and he presents the same issue that he confronted in 19. He's still running. He's still speaking from the press conference point of view. And you know the story? I've said it, and you may have missed it. In 1973, 74, Nixon, Nixon era? Yeah, I think it was. They started to do the cutbacks. The oil crisis. So the free food stamp world of the 60s wasn't there anymore. So Harold's
price
in trouble.
Controls.
He's going to have to make a living. What?
Yeah, he did put in price controls.
Right. So he gets talking to this psychologist, a female psychologist, and he's in trouble. He's going to have to get a job. And he hasn't worked in a long time. He's a professor at Wayne State University in the late 50s, early 60s. He is as a professor of geography. He goes to Peru and ends up living with Aborigines for a year or so. You know, right there in the jungle, being with them. He gets sidetracked into that. So when he comes out of the jungle, he comes back to New York to Detroit, and the Beatles and Bob Dylan is happening. It's like 1965. The whole all America has totally changed. So he sort of tunes into this with a famous guy named John Sinclair who ran the White Panthers, who did MC5. They had the band Kick the Motherfuckers Out. Kick the Jams Out, Motherfuckers, was their song. And they were the White Panthers. So he joins that commune and group of people. So he's part of the radical world, 65, 66, 67. He gets a job teaching in California, And he causes all kinds of shit at that school, and he decides not to mark his students, so they kick him out, and then he goes to New Paltz. So he's in New Paltz for a couple of years, then he's arrested, then he gets out, then he starts doing one of the first people with a video port-a-pack off the boat, along with Nam June Paik and a few other guys. So he starts making TV shows for cable, because Time Warner had to put in a cable public channel to have cable TV. That was the deal. They got to give one channel to the people. So he starts doing these interviews. Then the Nixon price control problem comes in. So he's talking to a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist wants to meet R.D. Lang and a few other famous psychologists of that period. Harold knows them, has access to them, and says, okay, you certify that I'm mentally incompetent, I will get you these people for your conference. And she did. She signed, you know, he's mentally incompetent, doesn't have to work. He can stay on welfare. You know what I mean? That was the deal. If you get signed over. And this is a former professor at a university. And he still wants to carry on the same interview with everybody. So he is insane. He actually is insane. But he's smart enough to get the certification. So he invites Artie Lang and all these famous psychiatrists. The woman is forever indebted to him because he brought all these famous guys over that she wanted to meet in profession. He's there interviewing them all, and they all have a great time. She gets to have her conference, put it on a resume. He gets to be declared insane, and he's cool for another 10 years. And so then in the early 80s, it gets worse because Reagan is going to make it even worse, cutbacks, right? 10 years later.
Yeah.
And so he's in trouble again. But he meets an artist woman, and she seems to be well off, so he moves in with her. So he continues interviewing people every week on his cable show for another, well, it's now 30 years. He's been still doing it. And then that woman dies, and he's in this really smart building. Ornette Coleman lives in the building. And then he meets another woman who lived near in the building but had a rich guy who, she told me, they plotted, these Wall Street guys, to take over the Canadian water industry or something right there in their home. She witnessed it all. But then he divorced her, so he left. She stayed there. Harold moved in with her. So then they're together for like the late 90s. Now, we called Harold a couple of years ago, if you remember, on the show.
Yes. Yes.
And you can hear it in the archives, and Harold is being threatened to be evicted. Now, he gets over that, and he's okay now, but that was the crisis he and his girlfriend of that point. So he's interviewed everybody for decades, and it's always the same question, which is what he said on his press conference in 1971. October 12th, that's the date. It's his birthday, and it's the date when it's his version of Rai returning to the plane of essence. You know, I say in January 22nd, Rai returned to the plane of essence. The old issues of survival don't apply anymore. Well, he says it happens on October 12th, 1971. Now, the joke here is that he knew McLuhan, but he favored Bucky Fuller. I knew Bucky Fuller, but I favored McLuhan. Two fanatics who've been saying the same thing for 40 fucking years have an occasional argument. That's what's funny about that. And I, of course, am smarter, cooler. Harold, he can't, I don't know, he, like you say, he loses it eventually. I just maintain integrity. I fucking keep my cool the whole 10 times we have our fights.
Yeah, but the... A couple of those sessions, you said, I have the solution, Harold. I have the solution.
I predicted all. Well, did you see what I wrote in what that first interview in 1990 that got posted in Knot magazine? Did you see what I said? It's incredible what I was
in 1990,
saying.
No.
Yeah, you know, 10 years before Harold. But before I go into that, go back to what I'm telling Harold. This is starts in 2000, goes to 2008. Yeah. Carolyn's got Mir, but then we drop Mir, and I'm claiming that Pons and Fleischmann got the cold fusion breakthrough. It's I am basing it on nothing.
Yeah.
We're not doing it Mir anymore. We're not doing Pons and Fleischmann are getting nowhere with Coldplay. But I insist that it's going to happen anyway.
Yeah.
That we're going to fucking do something. That's what fucking incredible. I bet that I was right no matter what the fuck was happening around me. We all had lost faith on it. I said, I have the solution. I have the solution, Al. Now, here's a funny thing. This is how it's always a poetry of synchronicity. Harold, who has no clue about the New Age, he hates it, he never understood it, he didn't do anything, he just can't understand it, or he claims he doesn't. He bumps into Jane, who channels Seth, somewhere on his walking around in his insane robotic life. Okay? So he tapes, what's her name? Jane Roberts. The famous Jane Roberts, who channeled Seth. He, it may be the only thing, I think you can see it on YouTube, he tapes, he said, this strange lady started talking, all this crazy stuff. I had my video camera way back there when people didn't have video cameras. He had one, and he taped her. So in our second matchup in September 2000, I come on and play the Evergreens, and he plays the Seth tape. You would have watched that, right? And he's there going, I don't know what this is, Bob. I don't understand any of it. It's fucking ridiculous. And I say, well, don't look, fuck, but I'll tell you what it is, Harold. And then I'll tell it to him and explain it. He'll go, I don't understand, Bob. I say, you don't make a fucking effort to understand, Harold. You just keep saying you don't understand. You're so fucking stupid. It's ridiculous how you are. He's so narrow-minded. And he says, well, Bob, it's all about that. I said, no, it's not all about economics. And he said, it's all about economics. So the irony of it is that 9 years later, Ion shows up, an expert on Seth and Jane Roberts, and talks about them and has that whole thing and talk about them just like he can the Evergreens. In other words, Harold, it's like me and Harold, we put Evergreens and Seth together on that show. And 9 years later, the confluence of that, the third part of that antithesis of Jane versus the Evergreens becomes Ion. It's right there in the poetry of our topic.
Yeah.
Ion pops out of the interplay of the Evergreens and Seth. That's what's pretty poetic about it. And I can't get Harold to realize what we're doing.
Then when you called him last year, wasn't Ion on the line, or didn't he get a chance? Or I mean,
I told him all about Ion. I explained it in detail. Ion wasn't there. For some reason, Ion wasn't there. And I was just talking to him. And what happened is I had a long talk with Harold for like 40 minutes, and when I finished, I said, what do you think of that? And nobody's there. Everybody got cut off and missed a good chunk of it. And I thought everybody was hearing all this great dialogue. It was great nuttiness I was getting out of Harold. Nobody heard it. I guess there's a short segment of it, but not all the good stuff. And he explained a lot, but he explained a lot of what happened to him. And it really illustrated, Harold, these problems are going to happen to you as long as you ignore me. As long as you don't get right with Ion, you will have big problems. And he was expressing it all and didn't know it. And there he is, him and Mark Stallman, arguing, and Mark, and he does the same thing to Mark. He says, Mark, you're going on about media and hot and cool media. It's all about economics. Now, Stallman is an economic analyst and out of Wall Street, but Harold and him can't meet on it. Anyways, tell me some more impressions of our debate. It is two fanatics arguing against each other that are not going to budge.
Yes. The one noticeable point from the six interviews that I saw is to see how old is he?
He's born in 1935, so he's 65 in 2000. So I see him from 65 to 74, so to speak. Those nine years is when he is his age during those debates. 65 to 74.
Because it was funny to see how in each interview it seemed like his ability to talk deteriorated. His voice sounded totally different.
Yeah, it was two of them in 2000, and then it doesn't happen until 2004 when the Robin Williams movie came out, The Man of the Year, with a character named Tom Dobbs, who becomes President of the United States, and it's exactly my scenario about how I won the Secret Council 10. And he doesn't get all the subtleties, but he just can't believe that it's my name in this movie. And that's why he invites me back on. And that's a good point. That's his anachrony, but I can't get him to understand that. And then I'm back in 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008 for a total. But there is a four-year gap there where he ages or gets weaker.
What's funny is because I listened to 2000, 2004, and 2006, and what's funny is that I had to go back and listen because each the beginning always sound the same.
Oh, yeah. He says
how he opened up with you. Good friend. But then one time I noticed it was different because then he said you were a media psychiatrist and you corrected him.
Yeah.
He said, yeah, Bob is a media psychologist. No, media college. Yeah, media college. Good friend. Coming by.
Yeah, Harold never prepared. And you know how he always signs off? It's been your pleasure to hear the wisdom of Bob Dobbs. He says as he says to the audience, it's been your pleasure, not his pleasure. It's been your pleasure to hear. That's what he says every time. And when he tapes it, you'll see we're talking. So what he does, we talk, and we get talking. And then after 2 minutes of chatting, he'll turn to the mic and goes, oh, hello, as if you've just walked into the room. Welcome back. Welcome here. I'm just talking here with Mark Stallman. Mark Stallman's an old friend of mine. He says that to everybody. He never sees these people. They never see anybody ever again. It's bullshit. You know, he's not their friend. I was his friend because he liked Carolyn. He would invite us to the Thanksgiving dinner. So I actually did go to his place many times in that 10-year period or 8-year period, but Mark Stallman never did. Mark's not a good friend of Harold's. He's a good friend of everybody that he has on. And, you know, it's up to like 3,000 interviews now or something. It's incredible.
Mm. Also, there was another interesting is that before the screen would come on, you would hear background like, hey, is that door open?
Close that door back
there. Hey, no. Is this guy ready? You know, and there's no screen, but you hear the sound, and then all of a sudden you start talking. It's like, wow, that's pretty raw TV.
Yeah, that's Harold would do
no
that.
Visual.
Yeah, I think he meant that. You know, you'd be eavesdropping, and he'd be trying to get the technician to pay attention because he always had some amateur volunteer. If you notice, Mark Stallman is spelled wrong. He was always spelling everything wrong, whoever had the shit on there, and they had me spelled wrong backwards. It was always fucked up. But Harold is basically talking constantly all his life. Every day he's taking calls, arranging. Mm-hmm. He had to do two or three of them a week back then. And not so much, I think it's only one a week or something now, but he was always, every day, had to find a new guest for his show. So he's always on the phone, talk, and he's always saying the same thing from the same position with everybody comes in, and it's very easy. Oh, okay, the people don't know who you are. Let's hear about your background. And he does get a lot of background out of people that you wouldn't normally get. In any interview, nobody gives you their history. He gets their history, and that goes on for about 20 minutes. So you find out a lot of different interesting people. You find out stuff. And so he spends a lot of time, wastes time of them talking their history. And then Harold gets excited. Oh, yeah, I went to that school, or I know that person, you know, and he's just going along. And then he gets into them to talk about their position. So they get to talk about their position, say, from 22 minutes into the interview till about the 30-minute mark. So they get 8 minutes to say their bit. And then right around then, Harold says, wait a minute. We've had 2,000 years of scarcity. Now there's no more scarcity. And we're either going to wipe ourselves off the map or change. And the person wonders how that relates to what they've been talking about. Right? And it throws them. And then Harold's got them by the balls for the next 25 minutes. And Mark Stallman, you watch that one. That's the third time. He knows the game, and I've talked to Mark about it. You know, we've analyzed. You'll see, he says, fuck that. He goes, forget that, Harold. We're not talking about that bucky full of shit. Mark calls him on it. Harold gets mad. He says some things back at Mark. It's almost like a club. It's a club, you know, a New York club with these endless new people passing through. because Harold had a huge party every December 15th, a huge Christmas party. Thousands of people would come to his big apartment and wander through. And Harold would always meet a whole bunch of new people in the party that would help him, that he'd do interviews with for the next 6 months. That's how he got new interview people. Strangers would show up because they'd heard about the party, and many people would mingle and meet there of the intellectual elite of New York on the street level, not the Henry Kissinger level or the institutional guys, but the street intellectuals would all end up at Harold's.
So, Robin, do you know Harold?
I've seen him on the television when I was in New York. Yeah.
Yeah, Manhattan Neighborhood Network
program. Manhattan Neighborhood Network. Yeah, it's the cable public access channel.
Yeah, yeah. So you've seen the bald Harold. You've seen him.
Absolutely. I always thought he was a riot, dull as dishwater, but basically a riot. He has his shtick. It's sort of like a sitcom. It's like a sitcom. I mean, part one is this, and then you have the beginning, the middle, and the end. And he has his formula. He's formulaic.
Yeah, he's very passionate.
Passionate but formulaic. You just put it out there.
He's actually a nut.
In 10 minutes, you explained it all. Yeah, he's a crazy
guy.
But you know what?
I think he's
having a fun.
Having a what?
You think he enjoy? I think he's having fun. Do you think he enjoys?
Oh yeah, he's a prankster like me. He's setting everybody up. He's a prankster. So listen
and
to this.
He's deadpan.
I was in New York.
He's deadpan too. He can be a very
deadpan. He's very deadpan. That's right. I can make him laugh. I could get him. He loses deadpan with what I would do. But here's the thing. I get to New York in 93, so I start watching the cable late 93 and early 94. I saw him about 94, and he was more intense. He was younger and healthier and more intense and passionate.
Uh-huh.
I said, that fucking guy's a nut. I said, it's interesting how he's intense and he's intelligent, but there's something, his eyes are bulbous. He's got Sam Peck eyes. There's something off about him.
There is.
So I never watched him. Okay? Yeah. So that's 94, 95. I never watched him. 98, March 28, 1998. I'm doing the McLuhan conference at Lincoln Center. And near the end of the day, I go up and I'm sitting up at the back, and there's gradually not many people there. And I look over and I immediately recognize him. There's Harold. I recognize his fucking head. And he's standing there. And he's sitting there. He's just like me. He's watching everything, and he stays the whole day, and he's looking for new people to interview. So I look over at him. He sees me looking at him. He goes, what? I says, you ought to interview me. That's the first thing I say to him. He doesn't know I know him. And I said, you ought to interview me. And he said, why? I said, I'm the most knowledgeable guy on McLuhan ever that you ever heard. And I didn't know he knew McLuhan at that point. I said, I'm the most knowledgeable guy about what you're hearing here today. And he said, well, that may be so. And he turns away and ignores me. So we say no. We say no words. That's that. 2 years later, Alan Steinfeld discovers me. And I get interviewed in their studio on April 14, 2000, and that's the day the dot-com blew up. So it's my first time on TV in New York City. It fucking changes everything. We now know why, thanks to Aya. It just was curious back then. But everything collapses. Well, Harold Channer saw that interview, and he says to Alan, who is that guy? I got to interview him. And so Harold comes over, and I get introduced to him. So we do the interview. That's the June one, the first one, where we go do a lot of McLuhan. And the first one, we might even have some footage. So he invites me to his party within a week or so to something going on into the summer, June, July. And so I go there, and I meet Giorgio Gomelsky, which was a great meeting. Giorgio Gomelsky is the guy who created the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and everything. He's the big hidden secret of rock, of British rock. But I don't want to go into that for a minute. So later, after talking to Giorgio, we hit it off and talk a long time. Harold's there talking to everybody, bopping around. And then there's this black guy. And he looks over at me, and I look at him at some point, and he says, I think we've met. And I said, I don't know. Who are you? He says, my name is Ornette Coleman. I go, holy fuck. That, you know,
oh,
Ornette Coleman's
wow.
the greatest jazz guy for many yes. decades, right? I go, I had met Ornette Coleman in 1972. And here it is, 30 years later, 2000.
Wow.
And he's totally changed. Like, he's thinner and older and that. And he says, Ornette Coleman. And I tell him we met. So we get together and we start talking and we start finning his wake and have a very good conversation. So he gives me his phone number and I'm going home. Holy shit. This is incredible who I met through Harold. Georgia Gomelski, a big deal in rock, and Coleman,
Ornette
a big
Coleman.
Deal in jazz. He had a MacArthur Grant at that point. You know, the genius grant?
Okay,
He had that, and he lived in Harold's building. So a week later, I call up his phone number, and I go on and on explaining this and that, and I leave a long message, and he never calls back. And I find out about 4 days later that he smashed his hand a few days before, and he would be laid up for a year or more. He almost ruined his playing. So when I called him, he was in the hospital, and I guess I never really called back. So he was in no mood. So I never got a chance to go into details, other than in 2007 or 2008, before I moved to Hawaii, I went to his apartment and knocked on the door. Well, first of all, you can't get into the building. So I knew Harold was not there. So I went to the building, and I looked up addresses and everything, and I found out the apartment number of Ornette Coleman was on the New York Times, you know, on the newspaper. I figured it out. So I buzzed the door, and I said, I'm here. I have a message from Harold Channer. I need to speak to Ornette Coleman. They buzzed me in. Okay. So I get up there, and you can't get in there, but I got up there. So his aide comes to the door, and I give him. It's the very thing that's highlighted today on Ed's website, the media approach to inflation article by McLuhan. That's the big thing today. I hand a copy to when the door opens, I can hear them practicing around the corner in the apartment. And so they stop, and the guy comes to the door, and I said, this Ornette should read this. And he says, okay, thank you very much. And so mission completed. I got my chance to turn Ornette on to McLuhan, which I would have done 7-8 years before if we had continued talking.
Right.
So I finished it, because I had to give a copy to Harold, and I think I must have left him his in his mailbox or something. That was it. So I said, I got an extra one. I got to give it to Ornette. So I told the guy to tell Ornette to tell Harold about what he thought of the article. So a week later, I call Harold, and he's not heard from Ornette, and he said he'd tell Ornette, but he never did. He told me later, I can't bother that guy. I don't want to bother him. So I never found out what Ornette thought of what I gave him. So that was the. But it was you could meet all kinds of interesting people at Harold's. He really was a hub, a switchboard of intellectual activity in New York. It's and yet they all respect Harold. They don't know he's a nut. He really is. You can see it. You look through closely at those things. And if you know his history.
Well, you know, they respect Harold because he comes off as being professorial. Okay,
yes.
Number one.
He wears the suit.
And, exactly. And his diction and the way he speaks, and you can think of him as being an old-time professor.
And he knows a lot about everything.
And he knows a lot. He can talk small talk about practically anything with lots of good juicy detail.
Yeah.
And he knows a lot of interesting people. So people automatically are going to respect him and think that they're going to have a good time and meet some interesting people through him. And it just keeps going, you know? Yeah. And the ball keeps rolling year after year.
Yeah, over the 8 years, I introduced him to a lot of people that I knew. I turned him on to a lot of people he didn't know. So it was two networks crossing.
And you're just two. Think of all the other ones. It's all multiple networking.
Harold
he may be a nut, but he was brilliant at that.
Well, the people aren't observant. They don't have time. They don't watch. They didn't talk to him 10 times. They don't notice that he's repeating himself. I watched his many of his shows. I had nothing else to do in the morning. I'd watch his show, and I'd watch him interview all these people, and he did the same fucking thing in every interview. Nobody else called him on it. I was the only one to call him on it.
No, nobody cares. They've got their own stuff.
Yeah, they don't care. They're not learning.
No.
I'm fucking listening. I'm dangerous. I pay attention.
Yeah.
Because you're the observer type.
Yeah. And you can see it.
And I just sit there and I listen to everybody, and then I say, "Oh, that's interesting. So and so did this, and they're there."
Oh, you do that too. You're a listener.
Every week.
You're saying you're a listener.
I'm an observer. Yeah. I'm an observer and a listener.
Right.
And
well, you'll notice
it.
You've got to look at these interviews. You got to look because you'll see. As we by the second or third interview, 2004, I know his shtick, and he starts interviewing me with this thing, and I'm there nodding my head real violently. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I'm grinning, ready to go. Did you notice that, Bert?
Yeah. There was one interview where you busted him. You said, "Harold, the only reason I'm here is because your guest canceled, and I'm here talking to you."
Yeah. When in 2004, Andrew Crystal was in Ottawa at the National Archives, and he called me and he said, "I've got the McLuhan. There's a McLuhan Bucky Fuller correspondence here." So I said, "I got to get to Ottawa." So I eventually got to Ottawa. These are the archives I partly organized for McLuhan's widow. And I've got the correspondence and what McLuhan said about Bucky, his critique. And I came on one of the shows, and I think I read it. I don't know. Maybe you haven't got to that one yet, Bert. But I have the content of McLuhan, his rebuttal of Harold, which is he never had that. He didn't have Bucky's rebuttal of McLuhan. So that should be in one of those interviews. I have the documents to show where, and I just posted it about 2 months ago on my Facebook page, the McLuhan's criticism of Bucky Fuller. I don't think Harold would understand it, but it's pretty interesting what McLuhan says about Bucky Fuller. And they were good friends, and they had a press conference in 1971, and they both talked at the same time. It was supposed to be a dialogue between them. They both chattered like two autistic people. They didn't listen to each other. They both just kept talking side by side to each other. And Robert Fulfer wrote an essay on it or an article in the newspaper. It's pretty funny. Two solipsists, two autistic guys, two great minds. Well, then me and Harold repeat that. I mean, it's many times. I don't know. You'll notice. Harold starts. Harold starts saying something, and I'll go, "Harold, I know that, Harold. You don't need to run through that again."
You're the great mind, yes. And he's the crazy.
Yeah. Now, when I told Harold what we were doing on that phone call a year or so ago, I pointed out for him, I blew it. You're doing that new age stuff, Bob, that stupid stuff, and he has not. I stopped getting emails from him. I think he's caught me out because I ruined my image in his mind of what I do. I tried to tell him we had the solutions. He does not believe that. He does not believe there's going to be a solution.
That's what you always said. I mean, there were a few interviews where you said you had the solution.
Yeah.
The man with the solution.
And what does he say?
Really nothing. He doesn't even acknowledge. Like,
yeah, he doesn't acknowledge what I say.
No. No. But, Bob, I think I remember the interview because I think when you talked about McLuhan and Bucky Fuller, Harold didn't know that they were friends. Is that correct?
Right. He didn't know they were that as connected as I knew they were.
Right. I saw that interview. Yes, I did see that one. Yes.
Yeah.
Because I remember that because he's like, they were friends? Yeah. And then you...
Yeah. The thing about Harold, he actually doesn't listen. I notice he never takes anything in that somebody says. He can talk at gossip level, but he doesn't learn anything. He's never learned anything in the Mm-mm. since he got declared insane. He's only got he in a way confided to me. That's what I called him on it. We used to have private discussions. I said, Harold,
mm-hmm.
you say the same thing every day. You sucker them in. You pretend you're interested in their topic, but you're not. You want to confront them with the fact that we have gone 200,000 years under scarcity, and we're not scarce anymore. And this is a big crisis for everybody's identity. And you think we're going to blow ourselves up because we can't meet the test. This is what you do to everybody. He goes, that's, he smiles. He goes, yes, that's what I do, Bob. I said, yep,
uh-huh.
you do. You're a fucking prankster. Now, then I would say, you've met your match, but I do the same thing, Harold. I've never changed one fucking inch in 30, 40 years. I've said the same fucking thing. But
to
my surprise, I called him up last year and said, hey, Harold, I've changed. There's something new. It worked. I actually do have the solution. And he couldn't hear it. He couldn't register on his brain. He just went on about his problems, on and on.
Yeah.
I don't remember what show it was, but you were on there with some spiritual healer.
Yeah, that was Frank. Frank had me on his show. He was a New Age guy, and he was in between me and Harold. He was a political guy like Harold. He knew the ideas, but he could accept the New Age flaky stuff, and he was that. So he was the only guy Harold knew that would tolerate mediumship, so that's why he was on when we presented the Evergreens and Seth. Frank was the like a protecting go-between between me and Harold, because it was, here's Harold, he tapes fucking what's-her-name. He's always saying, I don't know what she's doing, I understand what you're saying, and I tell her what you're saying. He says, I don't know, I can't understand that stuff, Bob. I'm into economics. He says the same fucking thing like a same person. Every time he'll say, I don't understand that stuff, Bob. I'm into economics. I think economics is the most important thing. And he says that every time, the exact same lines.
Yeah, because that one interview where we had the other, what's his name, Frank? Frank said something, and then Harold went on to this whole thing, and then that's when you start laughing. I said, are you listening? Are you listening to us?
Yes.
Are you listening to us?
Yes. Now, that was a few months later. I didn't know him that well. I probably generally said, you're not listening. I probably started to notice, you're not listening, Harold. That's probably the first time I noticed it, because it's just a few months later in September 2000, and did the first one in June. And then I don't basically interact with him for 4 years. Maybe we talk on the phone a bit, but he doesn't have me back. And it's only because of Zanarchrony, the movie. He called me up. He says, Bob, there's a movie about you. How does this be? How could this possibly be? I said, I'll explain it. Yeah, okay, you interviewed me, and I'll explain it. So I try to explain it, but it goes deaf. He doesn't hear it.
Mm.
But he does start to have me back, and things sped up after that. Things were getting – Ian was lurking. I mean – 2 years later, well, you take that Dobbs thing becomes president. That's 2004. A year later, Carolyn meets JW. A few months after that, I'm talking to JW. So I'm dealing with JW all through 2006, and I'm being interviewed by Harold in 2006. So I could, I had that starting to happen to me.
ESP.
Yeah, yeah. So I basically, I think Howard's Harold's disgusting. I think anybody who can't see what's going on here with Ion, that's fucking stupid. This is the litmus test of whether you're a human being or not, or an actual intellectual or an explorer. If you can't respond to Ion, you are stupid. And no matter how much you thought you were smart.
He's not an explorer, and he's not curious.
He does think he's running a revolution. And it's based on Louis Kelso's economics.
Kelso
is the thinker.
Oh, I remember that,
You remember Kelso?
Yes, of course. That's not so 1960s.
Yeah, McLuhan quotes Kelso. He was blown away that Kelso was in the McLuhan book. He didn't know that.
Yeah.
I mean, I was always illuminating Harold's world back to himself, telling him new things about his robotic formula. He couldn't notice it. Yeah, and see, what Kelso did get legislation. He became a friend of Russell
exactly,
Long.
Exactly, the Keogh Act.
Maybe, I don't know what that is. Maybe that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just say this. Huey Long was the famous, Southern politician, and his son, Russell Long, became a senator or something.
Very well known. Big cheese.
Yeah, and he became a fan of Kelso. And Kelso got into Congress, and they brought in a certain kind of legislation where unions can take over factories or something. It has an acronym.
Well, it was shareholding, shareholders.
Yeah,
they became
shareholders. It had a term. It had some kind of, you know, acronym.
It was called the Key. It was the Keogh Act, K-E-O-G-H.
Okay. Yeah, all right.
Mm-hmm.
And
that
and
was
you know
the
what?
Name of the
Harold,
act.
Because Harold met Kelso in that period, mm-hmm. he would go down and lobby on behalf of Kelso and deal with Russell Long, and Harold did have an impact with his TV show of changing the of creating the legislation.
Absolutely.
He actually did accomplish that. Right when he's being, that's in 73, right when he's being declared, you know, insane.
Exactly. That's when the steel industry went to hell in a handbasket, and all the steel workers were going crazy because Japan had taken over all the steel manufacturing.
Right.
And all the heavy manufacturing was really going down the tubes. And that's
so
when
they handed
Detroit
it over
started
to the workers?
To get into trouble. Well, they didn't hand it over. They just got shareholdings. They were allowed to buy shares at like an inside price or given some. And I don't know really where the heck it went.
It faded out because, you know, by the Reagan era, digital economy, everything's obsolete.
Yes, it was gone. Right.
But that guy, this is what you don't know. It takes an observer like me to find this out. That guy that you're looking at on Manhattan Cable, he fucking brought in that legislation. Harold Channer was a big part of that. And you know the and that JFK movie by Kevin, what was that? Kevin somebody plays Jim Garrison.
Oliver
Stone's movie. Kevin Costner. Remember, Jim Garrison is a politician, attorney, district attorney or something in New Orleans. His politician is Russell Long. It's Russell Long in the movie. Mm-hmm. Garrison intrigues Russell Long, Russell Long intrigues Garrison. Jim Garrison, the Kevin Costner. So the Garrison becomes the famous Garrison investigating it because of Russell Long. And Russell Long gets involved with Kelso. So this Russell Long guy, he must be an interesting person because
they named a Senate office building after him.
Oh, is that right? In Washington?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so he and Harold's right in the middle of that. And that's basically all that Harold ever did in a practical world because nothing else happens. But Harold always, he's still a Kelso maniac. He still talks. He has the Kelsey, those professors who are Kelso advocates. They come to his parties. They come in. He interviews them. They repeat their interviews, the same fucking formulaic interview every time. And Harold just makes them that's his solution. If we can bring in Kelso economics, everything will be cool. And he's still waiting for it. And I keep telling him, no, we got five bodies now, Harold. That's not going to happen. None of that kind of stuff will happen. Not definitely. Well, Bob, did you know that for 200,000 years we've been operating in scarcity, and we're not scarce anymore? Yes, I know that. I know it fucking was declared on your birthday, October 12, 1971. I know that, Harold. And I'll say that. So I'll say his biography back to him. And he has given me the articles in the local papers, and he was set up by the local mafia. He was totally framed, but he never went and sued them. He just said, everybody, it's a post-scarcity world, no hard feelings, sorry you put me in jail, but I learned a lot, and you guys are assholes, but everything's cool. We must not create divisions anymore. He's like, in a way, he has a total hippie aesthetic. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Forgive everybody.
Yep,
love
I
everybody.
Do. Absolutely, yep.
But he doesn't look like one.
No. No, he doesn't.
No, it was the only, this in the 90s, 2000, there's nothing happening in America, in the United States, New York. It's being Disneyfied, it's fucking dead. The only thing on an intellectual level that's interesting is Harold's show, and I get on the show. That's my luck. I get to the center of the feeble New York intellectual world that's happening, you know? I get
and it
to be,
was.
And I'm the
feeble.
Main guy.
Yeah.
I'm interviewed the most.
Yeah. Yeah. It's,
And I never tried to find him.
It was quite amazing. No.
I told him to interview me in 98. He said no, so I dropped it. And then life brought us back together 2 years later through Alan Steinfeld. So that's how magic,
and
that's how you relax.
He's still running his shows.
He's still doing his show, and I'm still doing mine.
Right. And he still hasn't come back. I remember your original, you know, one of your, he chatted with Ion. It's a great.
That's who I'm confusing. I'm confusing Alan Seinfeld with Harold. That's
yes,
what that
Alan,
is.
No, Alan has
Alan
done an
Einstein. Alan is balding, Ion. But he's not bald.
That's right. Now, but you did watch six Channer things,
yes.
Not Alan Steinfeld.
Yes. I was confusing because I remember someone that from your New York City time spoke with Ion, and I was confusing, but it was Alan. I remember now.
Yeah,
now
he did that. We hooked up to his network, BBC Network or something, and BCC. Now, here's the thing. He and Harold are my two problems in New York. Alan Steinfeld meets me first. He's a heavy New Age guru connector. He sponsors panels and everything. Have you ever heard of him aside from me, Robin?
Me?
Did you?
Yes, of course.
You knew about him. He had a long time show.
I used to watch his show too. Yeah.
Yeah, New Realities. He had a show for years.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows everybody. Dan Winter, he stayed at Dan Winter's last year. Dan Winter is me interrogating Ion about Dan Winter, what he says about death that led to the, you know, how do you feel to be stone cold dead? That three-tape series is done caused by Alan and Dan Winter. So I met a lot of people through Alan Steinfeld too. So this is New York's intellectual life in the 90s. It's people having a cable TV show. It's so discarnate. You know, it's not a bunch of, you know, abstract artists down in Cedar Tavern in the Village anymore. There's no Dylan.
True.
There's no folk music. There's nothing.
That's
it's
it.
All on the media.
No.
Andy Warhol
That's
even
correct.
Had a show in the 80s on Manhattan Cable. So Alan and Harold go way back. So Alan becomes a connector and a go-between and a switch, a Grand Central Station, what's the other one, a telephone switchboard for the New Age world all over North America and into the world. He's the opposite of Harold. He's doing what Harold does not recognize.
Yes.
And Alan will not tolerate Harold's formulaic intellectuality. They're very good friends, long friends. Every New Year's, every Thanksgiving, I go to Harold's for Thanksgiving, Alan be there. So it's me, Alan, and Harold, the two factions, and Bob and Connie there. You know, the two spectrum was right there. And here it is, Channer, from his perspective, can't absorb Ion, and neither can Steinfeld.
No.
Steinfeld can't afford it. If we bring Ion into his Steinfeld's network, it all falls apart. Their stuff doesn't hold up compared to Ion. Ion can't afford to accept what Ion's saying. It would undermine everything that he does in New York in the New Age circuit.